From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. An appeals court ruling this week dealt a severe blow to the NCAA, unless it didn't. Ahead on Only a Game, a look at what the ruling really means for college athletes and the future of their governing body. Also, the Washington Nationals establish a youth baseball academy in their backyard, a professor debunks the debunking of the hot hand theory, and a gripping tale of counter-espionage in basketball in Idi Amin's Uganda. Also ahead, families across the country are struggling to cover pay-to-play sports fees. One man and his foundation stepped in to help.
People look at me like I'm doing so much for them, but what I'm doing is pretty simple. Taking money from somewhere and making sure it goes to someplace where it's needed.
Stay tuned. The NCAA suffered a huge loss this week when the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that some of the organization's amateurism rules violate federal antitrust laws. That is, unless the NCAA got a huge win this week when the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the organization need not require schools to pay players for the use of their likenesses. I'm confused, so I called up Michael McCann, who writes about sports law for Sports Illustrated. Michael, which is it? Was this ruling a win or a loss for the NCAA?
Well, Bill, it's a little bit of both. I think it's mostly a loss for the NCAA because the Ninth Circuit affirmed the earlier court's ruling that the NCAA is in violation of antitrust laws and also is subject to antitrust laws. The NCAA has argued that it's in the business of education, that it's not appropriate for it to be judged under antitrust law. There was a Supreme Court decision that it keeps citing from 1984. The Ninth Circuit said, no, you are subject and you're in violation. So I think going forward, it's certainly not a good thing for the NCAA. But as you noted, Bill, in this particular case, the NCAA got a bit of a break because its members won't have to spend up to $5,000 a year paying athletes in name, image, and likeness rights.
Michael, I want to make one thing clear before we go any further. The ruling basically says the NCAA is violating the antitrust laws by doing what?
They're violating the antitrust laws by its members, and the members include all of these universities across the country and the conferences, that they have conspired through amateurism rules to prevent athletes from being adequately compensated for the use of their name, image, and likeness. Now, that's the big takeaway. But the Ninth Circuit also said that the NCAA and its members only need to provide the cost of attendance, at least as of now. But it's still a ruling that other cases going forward, the lawyers could say, hey, look, the NCAA is subject to antitrust laws. It's in violation. We're going to try different arguments.
Well, that, of course, is the next question, implications going forward. I've got to imagine that Jeffrey Kessler, the attorney who brought free agency to the NFL, has been watching the Ninth Circuit very closely. Tell me a little about the lawsuit he's brought against the NCAA and the implications of the decision this week on that.
So Jeffrey Kessler has had many smiles recently, obviously representing Tom Brady and winning Brady v. NFL. Most recently, but he's also, as you mentioned, Bill, he's representing a college lawsuit, and it's brought by Martin Jenkins and other college players who argue that the NCAA is in violation of antitrust laws by capping the value of athletic scholarships to room, board, tuition, cost of attendance. Kessler argues that that's not the right metric, that in a market that's free and unrestricted, college athletes might get $500,000, maybe $1 million in an athletic scholarship. And he's probably really happy after this decision.
Now, just to keep this ping pong match going, also in the decision that came down this week, the court said offering cash sums untethered to educational expenses would turn NCAA sports into minor leagues. That doesn't sound like very good news for athletes who want to be paid fair market value.
Absolutely, Bill. That is language that the NCAA is going to look at this decision and say, this is good language for us. But Kessler could say that language relates to name, image, and likeness rights. It doesn't relate to athletic scholarships.
I'm really glad we could clear this up so now we know exactly what the decision means. All right, Michael, give me some sense of how this is all going to turn out.
I think the NCAA will change its rules to allow for more compensation for student athletes, particularly those student athletes that are marquee student athletes. Kessler's lawsuit really focuses on the star players, the players that are worth more to their schools than the value of an athletic scholarship, and he believes they should get more. If his case succeeds, that's a game changer.
Michael McCann writes about sports law for Sports Illustrated, and he's the director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at the University of New Hampshire as well. Michael, thank you for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
Time now for three stories you should know, this week featuring George Vesey, author of 8 World Cups, among other books, and Shira Springer, who writes about sports for the Boston Globe. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Great to be here.
George, your New York Mets have made the playoffs, which is not the topic you're here to discuss today, but congratulations are, I think, in order. So you go first.
Well, thank you. I'm harried from the experience.
Can I say I grew up a Mookie Wilson fan?
Don't tell anybody in New England about that, Shira. That's your little secret.
George, please.
Okay. The story that stuck with me this week was Larry Brown being suspended as basketball coach at Southern Methodist University. He admitted knowing about cheating to keep a star player eligible. I have to note that I have known Brown since he was playing summer schoolyard ball across from his family bakery in Long Beach, Long Island. I like Larry Brown, as old-timers often do when they go back a long way, but I don't like what he did. Personally, I prefer good, honest, professional sports, like taking steroids, giving bribes in soccer, and, you know, deflating footballs.
Hey,
Shira, you have a great topic.
All right, Shira, I'm going to turn this right over to you. Do you also prefer pro sports
in all
their glory to the college games?
I do, and for many of the same reasons that George does, because I just simply think that college sports at this point is tainted. The NCAA simply can't police it all, doesn't police it all. So you know me, though. I always want to go one step further. I want the radical solution, which is I think sports should be taken out of college. It's a bit of a farce to think that these students are really student athletes at the very top levels of competition, because really what you have is full-time athletes who are fitting in coursework. And that's what you saw with SMU.
Or not.
I was going to say, or having somebody else fit in coursework
exactly.
for them. So, I mean, let's, you know, stop the charade here.
Right. George, you want the final word on this?
I would say this. I have a granddaughter who wants to go to a very good school as a pre-med major and play Division I soccer. And what do you say about that? It's a wonderful tradition. If you throw out big-time football and basketball, what do you do with everything else, including women's sports?
Yeah, also, it might be important to point out that female athletes, by and large, have higher grades than
yes.
male athletes in the revenue sports,
right.
partly because they're smarter, but also partly because they don't have a big money opportunity to look forward to after college.
And I was going to say, I wish George's granddaughter a lot of luck, but I have a sister who did the same thing, wanted to do the same thing. She ended up following the pre-med track, but dropping the soccer.
Mm. Women have more sense than men.
If
there was ever any doubt about that up to now.
Shira, speaking of women, you have noticed that the Oakland Athletics have made a late season hire. Tell me why it's significant, assuming that it is.
It is significant. Well, a few days ago, the Oakland Athletics made history as the first Major League Baseball team to employ a woman coach. Justine Siegel, who's 40 years old, will be a guest instructor for their instructional league club. I believe she starts work October 4th, and it runs for a couple of weeks. Now, she also represents a trend now of women making inroads in men's professional sports, whether that's Jen Welter, who coached very briefly for the Arizona Cardinals during training camp and preseason. But I question if this is really progress. And my concern is, yes, these women make headlines and they're celebrated when they get these jobs. But my concern is there needs to be a pipeline. If this is to be true progress, a way for more and more women to find these jobs, to secure these jobs, and to make them full-time jobs that last years, not a matter of 2 weeks during the instructional league in October.
I think you make an important distinction between real job and temporary part-time job. And I also think the NBA is way ahead of Major League Baseball or the NFL. And my guess is the NBA will be the first men's league where a woman will be a head coach. George, perhaps you can speak to the issue of progress for women in the world of men's sports or lack of same.
Oh, absolutely. At the risk of self-promoting, in the which of course is what I do, the epilogue in my soccer book, 8 World Cups, shows me going back to Jamaica High School, my alma mater, where they still have a soccer team, and the coach was a Division I woman. The old school had gotten a 1-1 draw in a game they needed to win. And she said to them, "I am so proud of what you did, of the way you came back. I have nothing bad to say. You know, go catch your bus, go home, I'll see you tomorrow." If every male coach could pattern himself after that, after a game, we'd be way ahead in all sports.
Okay, my story comes all the way from Japan, where Olympic organizers have proposed the addition of 5 sports to the 2020 Games in Tokyo. Japanese organizers want baseball, softball, and karate. No surprise there. They're good at those things. The IOC reportedly is pushing for surfing, skateboarding, and sport climbing in order to appeal to younger fans. All these sports are likely to be approved, adding 474 athletes in 2020 anyway. This seems to me to contradict the notion that the Olympics should get less expensive, thereby attracting more nations to bid for them. More athletes, more sports, more money spent. Maybe there shouldn't be any more additions to the games without subtractions. And also, rock climbing in the Olympics, silly. Shira.
I disagree with you completely.
Excellent.
I think this is great. And I think the key thing that you mentioned is some of these sports are designed to attract a younger audience. And I'm going to tell you right now, one of the biggest thrills at the London Olympics was watching BMX racing.
But not rock climbing.
Well, listen, give it a chance. Give it a chance. Now, what was thrilling about BMX racing was the fact that you could have a race where all but one racer crashed and was knocked out. I must say, though, I'm not really looking forward to golf in Rio, but I do think this is one avenue for the IOC to keep the games fresh and interesting.
George, what do you think? Is more necessarily better when it comes to the Olympic Games?
Listening to the great Jessica Mendoza doing so well on television on Major League Baseball reminds me of how much I loved seeing softball, women's softball, in the Olympics. And I think they got shafted by an anti-baseball sentiment. And I do wish that sport were back because it is a sport that women play and play very well.
You're not for surfing?
Or rock climbing?
I'm all for them. But just, by the way, in Rio, just stay away from the water.
Yeah, yes. It's hard to do surfing on the land, though.
But safer.
My guests this week for 3 Stories You Should Know have been George Vesey, formerly of the New York Times, and Shira Springer of the Boston Globe. Thank you both.
Hey, anytime.
Thanks.
According to a 2014 survey by the C.S. Mott Children's Hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan, more than 60% of middle school and high school athletes in the U.S. report paying some sort of fee to play school sports. That presents a challenge for low- and middle-income families, and it keeps lots of kids from participating. But one organization wants to change that. Mike Foley of WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, has our story.
We're dinosaurs. We are.
Yeah.
People don't know how lucky they are. Their kids go to Buckeye and they play a sport.
Yeah.
They pay a high price for it, but they get to play.
Yeah, and they got the attitude.
Sitting at their kitchen table, longtime Medina, Ohio residents Patty and Glenn Reisner flip through 2 scrapbooks. The couple has seen the evolution of pay-to-play athletics firsthand. In 2005, the Buckeye Local School Board abruptly cut all sports. The Reisners had a senior and a freshman on the football team that season. They were looking forward to their boys playing on the same high school squad.
I think we got fiery mad when we realized that night that we had 2 crying kids out here. I think something just turned in us, like, they can't do this. We're not going to let them do that.
Public pressure led the school board to reconsider. Parents would need to raise $60,000, which they did. Golf tournaments, auctions, and an unselfish community funded sports for a few years, but eventually pay-to-play fees were put in place and remain today. Athletes this fall pay $395 per sport. Glenn Reisner, now the district's athletic director, says many families can't come up with that much money all at once.
I last year had about 100 people on payment plan out of my 500-some kids that participate. And I understand. I understand it.
Some estimates suggest more than 700,000 kids miss out on school athletics because their families can't afford the cost. New York filmmaker Andrew Wonder discovered that statistic while conducting research for a documentary.
We talked to a lot of schools, and we had a lot of schools tell us about ways they were handling pay-to-play, but
When Glenn Reisner came on the phone, he just jumped. And he started telling us his story about how they raised the money to keep the program alive here. And then he started telling us about Jalen. And it just felt like everything aligned.
We've got Andrew Wunder from the Right to Win Foundation in studio. And we've got Jalen Brock, who's a senior at Buckeye. And they're both joining us here. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
So, Jalen, before you met up with these guys, what was the struggle like trying to pay for these pay-to-play fees? Because that's a lot of money you're talking about there, $400 just to play football?
What would happen is my mom would get paid every week. And every
Wunder
Friday,
found Brock's story so compelling, he scrapped the film and, along with his best friend Dan Wright, established a foundation. Right to Win raises money from individual sponsors to cover sports fees for kids. Jalen Brock became the first recipient last year.
I'm not able to see my mom every day, so my teammates have kind of stepped in and became a second family to me.
Brock tells his story through a video on Right to Win's website. He had much more at stake than just being able to play a sport. While he was in eighth grade, Brock and his family were evicted from their home. It happened again his freshman year. But because he was able to play football, Brock found a stable home with the parents of one of his teammates, and they are his legal guardians.
I have about four families. Like, I have my real family, I have Hunter's family, which is my best friend, I have my girlfriend's family. Being with, like, my football family is like getting to play, like, the best game ever invented with my brothers all day long.
Brock no longer worries about being homeless or where the money for sports fees will come from. He's able to focus on football and classwork. He's been recruited by a few schools and plans to attend college next year. But Andrew Wunder's recruiting efforts are just beginning.
Yeah, this is actually my first house visit.
Wunder's on the road to meet Logan, the son of a single mom of four. Wunder says finding kids remains the biggest challenge because once they quit sports, they often drop out of school.
We're literally right by the park. Like I said, we're Red Pontiac D6.
I see 271. Oh, I see the basketball court. Okay, I see the Pontiac. Oh, I see the play. Oh, I see him.
Wunder and Logan chat about life, football, and the summer. Then they come up with a deal. If Logan can improve his grades to B's, Wunder will pay the football fee. If Logan gets A's, Wunder will pay for basketball too. Wunder planned to offer an academic challenge to each Right to Win applicant, but he has a problem with his next student. Sophomore Julianne Lee Finley.
That's cool. Where are your grades at now?
Really well. My average GPA last year was like a 4.4 or something.
Okay,
like that.
So that's nothing I could do to help you there.
A goalie on the soccer team, Finley dreams of attending veterinary school at Ohio State. Hearing that, Wunder quickly sees an opportunity.
So if the Humane Society certification for 40 hours, if we can get that done by the end of the school year?
Yeah.
You know, all you have to do is keep doing that, and then you'll be playing soccer as long as you want to play.
That's awesome. Uh-huh. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you.
Finley and her mom visibly exhale. They were still paying off last year's fees, and Wunder has decided to clear their account. He says it feels wonderful to help students, but admits it's hard to handle the gratitude.
It's weird for me because people look at me like I'm doing so much for them, but what I'm doing is pretty simple. Taking money from somewhere and making sure it goes to someplace where it's needed.
Wunder and I end the day at the Reisner's home. Patty proudly picks up her scrapbooks to put them away, but the memories of that challenging journey 10 years ago are always near.
There was a whole lot of moms, just like me, that loved their kids so much that they were willing to do anything that they could. Fundraise the way we did, do whatever we had to do, just so that little part of their life wasn't taken away. You know, I'm sitting here crying over this crazy book that I made, but any mom that I worked with at football felt the exact same way about their son.
Oh, yeah.
And what we did. They were worth it. They were so, so worth it.
Wunder's scrapbook is just beginning. He's now funding 7 kids with a goal of helping 20 by the end of the year. For Only a Game, I'm Mike Foley.
When workers broke ground on a $17 million baseball complex in Southeast Washington, the locals were skeptical. Most people looked at how green and perfect it was and immediately assumed it was going to cost a lot of money to come inside, the facility's program manager told Bill Pennington of the New York Times. Wrong. It was free. Bill Pennington joins me now. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about the neighborhood that's now home to the Washington Nationals Youth Baseball Academy.
It's a pretty gritty, tough place. It's Ward 7 and 8 in Washington. It's pretty much the most sort of downtrodden parts of the city. The poverty levels are the highest there. Crime is generally the highest there. It's a tough place to live. And then rising out of it is this baseball academy, which almost looks like a mirage amongst those tumble-down streets.
Chris Reed, the program manager whom I just quoted, told you, we're here to save lives. How does baseball save lives?
You know, baseball is just sort of the hook to get the kids to come through the door. As you said, it's all free. And there is some baseball and softball instruction, but there's much more help with their academics, tutoring, trying to change some of their lifestyle choices, especially when it comes to food and nutrition. The idea is that, hey, we've got this baseball team now in Washington, you know, a major league team in Washington, which it hadn't had a team there for many, many years. And I know a lot of the kids in the neighborhood didn't play baseball, but we're going to teach you how to play baseball, but we're also going to try and impact your life in a very positive way. And they spend a lot of money per student to do that. It's really organized and systematic. It's not just like, let's roll out a bucket of balls and while we're there, we'll be nice to these kids. No, they've got a very specific plan on what they're trying to do from each grade on up.
Bill, it would be easy to praise the Nationals and Major League Baseball for their altruism, but the sport has quite a bit to gain here, too. Most of our listeners are probably aware of the fact that baseball's fan base is older than those of the other sports. But how is that issue magnified in communities like the one where this academy is located?
Yeah, I mean, no, you're right. You know, the second goal is to help the sport and conceivably sell more tickets at Nationals games. But the reason it's a bigger challenge in Washington in particular is because they didn't have a team. And the reason why it's a challenge in cities all across America seems to be economic, really. Baseball increasingly, more so than other sports, especially at the elite levels of it, is a pay-for-play thing. You know, the numbers of baseball players in America in cities and in suburbs is dropping, but the drop in cities is dramatic. And, you know, you go into the neighborhood in Southeast Washington where this academy is, people not only don't follow baseball, not only can't name one Nationals player, they don't even know the rules of the game. You know, I talked to kids who didn't want to play because they thought that the way you were made out in a baseball game was that somebody threw the ball at you and that they didn't want to get hit by the ball. It sounded too dangerous. I mean, that's how stark the drop-off in baseball awareness has gotten in many American cities. They play football and they play basketball and they might run track and, you know, maybe play some soccer, but the baseball is way down the line.
This academy is still in its very early days, but do you see any evidence that baseball is coming back to neighborhoods like this?
Well, yeah. I mean, they hadn't had a Little League in this neighborhood, and nobody could remember the last time they had a Little League game in that neighborhood. And this year, this past spring and summer, they did have a Little League. About 140 kids played in the Little League hosted at the academy. It is definitely sort of a hub of activity. They've had something like 400 events there with about 1,000 people coming through the doors. I mean, not to watch, but to participate. And academically, while there isn't any hard data, I did go visit the schools that they partner with, and the principals there feel like it is helping, and the kids do too. I guess we really won't know for 10 years, let's say. It might take 10 years to see how it all shakes out, but so far so good, I would say.
You can link to Bill Pennington's New York Times story, Washington Nationals Use Baseball as a Beacon of Hope at Youth Academy at onlyagame.org. Bill, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
On an otherwise uneventful summer day at a tennis club in New York about 50 years ago, I began a match against the number one player in the tournament by acing him several times. Then I fell to earth. I don't think I got a dozen points through the rest of the match. Maybe I didn't get any, but for those few serves, I felt unbeatable. I had the hot hand, unless it was all an illusion. In 1985, an article from the journal Cognitive Psychology claimed there is no such thing as the hot hand, but a recent study calls that assertion into question. To help me sort all this out, I'm joined by Cornell psychology professor Tom Gilovich, one of the authors of that original 1985 study. Tom, first of all, help me out here. Summarize the findings you published in 1985, much to the dismay of other scholars who've been trying to debunk what you wrote ever since.
Yeah, we got a season's worth of data from the Philadelphia 76ers and looked to see if there was evidence of streak shooting. That is, are players more likely to make shots after having made one, two, or three in a row than they are after having missed one, two, or three in a row? And there was no evidence of that in the data, even though anyone who's ever watched or played the game of basketball just knows that players get hot.
Now, this new study suggests, just as I have always known, that the hot hand is, in fact, real. What did authors Joshua Miller and Adam Sanjorjo find? And please keep in mind that I have not taken a statistics class since well before Ronald Reagan was president.
Of the various claims that they make, there are some things I agree with, some things I disagree with, and some things, quite frankly, I still don't think I understand.
Oh, man, we're on the same page. That's great, because there's really a lot of it that I don't understand. Just to be clear, though, you and I have been talking about basketball, and their study talks about flipping a coin. We all know that flipping a coin is a 50-50 probability, but they say that's not always the case. How do they conclude that?
That's the more complicated part, and I'm not sure I agree with them on that. I think it's probably best if we stick to the parts that that I agree with them, that they've identified something new in this now 30-year debate on streak shooting, and the question is, how significant is that? How telling is that? And there's still disagreement there.
Okay, so tell me about the part you do agree with.
So suppose I'm trying to find out whether you shoot in streaks or not. I don't know anything about you, but you've taken 40 shots and you've made 20 of them. So you're a 50% shooter. And now I want to see, are you more likely to make a shot after having, say, hit three in a row than after having missed three in a row? So I'm going to compare probability of a hit after three hits with the probability of a hit after three misses. Okay.
Okay.
And you might think that if there's no streak shooting, those two things ought to be equal. And what they argued, and this is true, that no, if there's no such thing as streak shooting, those two shouldn't be equal, at least given the data that you have. That is, how likely are you to hit it after you've hit three in a row? Well, we've taken three shots, three hits out of your performance record. They're not eligible to be in the numerator. If we look at the probability you're going to hit after missing three in a row, we haven't taken any of your three hits away. So in other words, you would expect the probability of a hit after several hits in a row to be a bit lower than the probability of a hit after three misses. Paradoxically, contra common sense, showing that those two are equal is actually evidence of streak shooting. That's their claim, or part of their claim. And I agree with that part. In data sets that aren't large, this can loom large, but I don't think it's a very big effect in the kinds of data sets that have been looked at in the NBA.
You were quoted in a recent Wall Street Journal story saying, unlike a lot of the stuff that's come down the pike since 1985, your study, this is truly interesting. What interests you, the possibility that it might not be quite as right as I thought I was?
Since the 85 paper came out, that staked a claim that was counterintuitive. So therefore, any data that would seem to suggest, no, there is streak shooting, was just picked up instantly. And there were all sorts of articles saying, it's okay to believe in the hot hand. And there have been many studies over the years that purport to show that. They vary in quality enormously. And there's no way, if they'd come to the opposite conclusion, that they would have been trumpeted in newspapers and held up that way. And therefore, when you see a very carefully done study with an interesting argument, that's just a different kettle of fish. And this paper is like that.
All right. Well, you're a basketball guy besides being a research psychologist. The NBA season begins in less than a month. I'm going to be wondering if this study has an impact. Suddenly, all the three-point shooters are going to say, hey, I got to throw it up more.
When our research came out, this in the academic world, it attracted a fair amount of interest because of some possible extensions to other areas. So it's influenced a lot of things. I don't think it influenced many coaches or players. They'll just say, well, we knew it all along.
Thomas Gilovich is a psychology professor at Cornell, and he's the co-author of the 1985 paper, The Hot Hand in Basketball, on the misperception of random sequences. Professor Gilovich, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, revisiting the infamous Pine Tar Bat incident and the happiest day of Billy Martin's life. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
I'm looking at the NFL standings, and I see Seattle at 1-2, Cincinnati atop their division, a winless New Orleans team, and Baltimore at 1-3. Are we living in a topsy-turvy NFL world? How long does this last?
First of all, the Patriots are the only team in the league that doesn't stink. Okay, oh. I don't care if the Packers are undefeated.
Kind
I don't care if the Falcons
Boston
are undefeated.
Perspective, isn't it?
Yes, it is. They're the only team in the league that doesn't stink, which is, you know, exactly the way Pete Rozelle planned it, a completely consistent flat line of mediocrity.
Here's a weird NFL note. In preparation for their Sunday morning game at Wembley Stadium against the Miami Dolphins, the New York Jets sent over 350 rolls of toilet paper, extension cords, cereal, and gauze pads. What, they don't think they have those things in London?
The New York Jets management apparently was convinced that they were going to be playing this game on the steps. And I don't mean like leading up to St. Paul's Cathedral. I mean the plains
Russia
the or in Outer Mongolia.
I bet they have gauze pads in London. I'm
willing to bet they have toilet paper in London. Toothpaste, I'm not so sure about.
September marked the first month in 6 years that not a single NFL player was arrested. So good on them. Do you like the league's chances for two consecutive months of same?
Things are looking up. This reminds me, though, of a story. When I was in college, I was living on the 11th floor of a high-rise dormitory, and every month they would post the damages to each individual floor.
Right.
And 1 month, we had no damages. And 15 minutes after they posted the thing, somebody rode the elevator up through a coffee cup through a glass window and then rode it down again. Even mentioning this NFL thing is bad news.
Bad idea. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled this week that the NCAA cannot ignore the antitrust laws, which the association and lots of colleges have been doing for years. Do you think we will soon see a change in all things college sports?
I don't know, because the court also struck down the payment plan that Judge Claudia Wilkin had devised in her original decision on this case, and it accepted the NCAA's argument that somehow its product would be damaged if the players would be paid. So this was really a mixed decision.
The NHL regular season begins on Wednesday, so
whoa!
I hope you have saved a spot along the Zamboni parade route.
I have. You know, it's always fair weather when hockey players get together. What can I tell you?
The New York Islanders will play their first home game of the 2015 season in the Barclays Center, their new Brooklyn Digs. That led the team to consider changing their goal horn from the one heard for decades at Nassau Coliseum. Thought that would go on forever. Anyway, to a new one, which sounds like a Metropolitan Transit Authority train. You're shaking your head, and the people in the building didn't like it either, so they've gone back to the old one. Are Islanders fans too picky about their goal horns, or is that a good choice?
That's a great choice, because not only is it a great goal horn, it sounds like the musical score for the moment in the Thriller where you find out who the real killer is. Mm.
The Toronto Blue Jays clinched their first division title in 22 years this week. You like their chances to win it all this fall?
I love this team. Anybody who is only a casual baseball fan, as I am, should love this team. You know why? Because almost everybody in the lineup can hit the baseball really, really far, really, really often.
That's fundamental baseball.
I mean, it's just it's a terrific team to watch. It's got just enough pitching. I honestly hope they win the World Series.
If you were to say to a guy on the PGA Tour, hey, I know a caddy who made more than you did this year, it would seem like you'd be insulting the golfer, unless you were referring to the guy who caddies for Jordan Spieth, right?
Yeah, he made $867,000 this year. 2 years ago, Michael Greller, he was a sixth grade teacher. And now he picks up Spieth's bag, and he made $867,000, which would put him 93rd on the money list.
Finally, Charlie, I direct your attention
oh,
to Joe Gillespie, who believes that with regard to the manner in which he came into possession of the minor league Charlotte Knights mascot suit, there should be a distinction between breaking and entering and opening and exiting. Are you good with that?
Let me tell you a story before I answer your question. When I was another story from when I was in college, We all went to a Milwaukee Brewers game one time, and a friend of mine got overserved. And he went to use the facilities, and as people who are overserved or want to do, fell asleep in one of the stalls.
Oh, dear.
He awoke at 3 o'clock in the morning and then realized that the Milwaukee Brewers had left town on a 10-day West Coast road trip, and the only people in the building were he and the guard dogs. Now,
so we spent the next 10 days in the stall.
Now we have Joe Gillespie, who woke up at the bottom of a stairwell in BB&T Ballpark with no idea how he got there. Apparently, he'd been to a concert. So he found the dressing room for Homer the Dragon, the mascot of the Charlotte Knights, the minor league team, got into the suit, left the stadium, and caroused around Charlotte as Homer. And by Monday, he was in jail, and things were really bad for him.
But he says opening and exiting.
It was not breaking and entering because he was already there.
That's right. And the door wasn't locked. Besides, you can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks. If they don't let Joe Gillespie throw out the first pitch at a Charlotte Knights game this year, there's no humor left in the world.
In the late 60s and early 70s, a lot of people in the U.S. were protesting the war in Vietnam. Jay Mullen, who was teaching at a small women's college in 1971, was among them. In those days, some men grew beards to signify their opposition to the war, and Jay Mullen did that, and the college administration didn't much like it.
They asked him to shave his mustache or his beard, and he decided he didn't want to do that. He told them to go blank themselves.
That's Sean Revive. He wrote a story for BuzzFeed about Jay Mullen, and he's going to help me tell Mullen's story. Anyway, because Mullen needed a job, he went to work for the CIA. I know, but he did.
They sent him to Uganda. He sent his whole family to Uganda, in fact. And this was about 8 or 9 months, I think, after Idi Amin had taken over power with a pretty violent coup.
It was also when the Soviet Union was attempting to gain influence in Uganda, among many other places, and as part of their Cold War strategy, the U.S. needed to keep track of those attempts and perhaps recruit the odd double agent, which is why Jay Mullen was there. During the day, he taught at a university in Kampala, and in his spare time, he played some basketball.
It's one of the things that he did, you know, when he wasn't spying or, you know, teaching or hanging out with his family, was just play basketball at the courts there. He was just a guy who liked sports in general.
And as it turned out, a guy who knew more about basketball than the Ugandans with whom he was playing. So that when the coach of the national team, such as it was, fled the country, Mullen got the job. This meant that he was in charge in August of 1972, when the Soviet Union sent a very good men's team to Uganda, where their third game would be against the team Mullen was coaching.
He had seen how the Soviets played against two sort of inferior teams of Ugandans, and he saw how rough they played as well. And so he wanted to prepare his guys, who were much more talented than the other teams, to prepare for sort of rough play. And I think he may have over-prepared them.
The resulting game was a mugging in terms of the score. When play ended, the Soviets were up about 50, but Mullen had coached the Ugandans to mug the Soviets right back, which is perhaps why, late in the game, the Soviet coach called on the services of his largest, most physical player, Viktor Petrikov. Mullen was impressed.
He described him as like an incredible Hulk or Yao Ming with muscles. He was a sort of eighth man on the Russian team. But at the end of the game, he had a breakaway, and this was after all the roughness was happening. There was aggravation on both sides, coaches yelling at each other in a quote-unquote goodwill game. But at the end of the game, this big guy got a breakaway, got an alley-oop pass, and he dunked it so hard that the rim broke. And it was exactly one of two indoor rims in the entire country, so the game had to end.
Yeah, unless they were going to go play half court for the rest of the time, that was the end of the game.
Exactly. And there's actually a little, didn't make it into the story, I think, but the rim sort of hung a bit on like one bolt for a little while. And then apparently one of the Ugandan players, he thought it would be pretty funny to sort of finish the job. And he took the ball and threw it through this rim that was hanging out. And the whole crowd apparently left.
Which didn't mean the Cold War ended in laughter exactly, but at least the game did. A little less than a year later, Jay Mullen, teacher, spy, and basketball coach, bailed out of Uganda. In their infinite wisdom, the CIA decided he'd be safer in Sudan. Now he lives in Oregon, and when he was finished telling Sean Revive about his days as a spy, Mullen smiled and said, "I really don't care if anything that interesting ever happens again." You can link to Sean Revive's BuzzFeed story, Greatest Basketball Coach, at onlyagame.org. On July 24, 1983, in a game between the Kansas City Royals and the New York Yankees, George Brett hit a home run. This was not an especially unusual event. Over the course of his 21-year career with the Royals, Brett hit 317 home runs. But this one was special, or at least the aftermath of it was, as Philip Bondi explains in his new book, The Pine Tar Game. Philip, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks so much, Bill. It's good to be here.
I want to start with a little background. The Yankees of 1983 were owned and run by George Steinbrenner, the Royals by Ewing Kaufman. Did those two have anything much in common other than that they both owned baseball teams?
No, not much at all, which was one of the inspirations, I think, for writing this book. It was these two owners who couldn't have been more different, the sort of blustery, carpet-bagging George Steinbrenner on one side and the homemade multimillionaire from the basement of his mother's house. So very, very different, clearly.
All right, let's get to the Pine Tar incident itself. George Brett hit a home run to beat the Yankees. Yankees manager Billy Martin claimed the home run should be disallowed because Brett's bat had too much pine tar on it. I can't say that without smiling. When did the Yankees begin preparing to make a claim like that?
Original credit goes to Greg Nettles,
the third baseman for the Yankees.
You know, he was an instigator and a student of the game in the sort of most mischievous way. He noticed that the pine tar was up high on Brett's bat, and he also remembered that Thurman Munson had been called out for something just like this when he had hit an RBI single a few years earlier. So he told Billy Martin about it, saying, you know, let's wait for the right moment. But it was Don Zimmer, a bench coach, who told Billy, go out there, this is the moment. And Billy was only too happy to do so.
George Brett did not calmly accept the umpire's decision to void his home run.
Brett is out.
And he's steaming mad.
He is out and having to be forcibly restrained from hitting plate umpire Tim McClellan.
Now, I presume the Yankees, including Billy Martin, found Brett's outrage marvelously entertaining.
That they did. It's kind of funny because it's the world's greatest sports tantrum, and yet it only involves one team. this melee was only the Royals and the umpires, and the Yankees were kind of hanging back, laughing about it. Billy Martin was just in his absolute glory. Goose Gossage, who threw the pitch, you know, he meant to bury it in Brett's neck, and it sailed out a little bit, and Brett tomahawked it out. Afterwards, Gossage in the clubhouse went to Martin, and he said, I don't know what happened on that pitch. And Martin said, what pitch? You know, it didn't exist. The Yankees had fooled the world. This was Martin's great, great moment, and then it was stolen from him.
The Royals appealed to the American League. The home run was allowed. The appeal was successful, so the game had to be replayed from the point of Brett's home run. Tell us a little bit about the day upon which that happened.
Billy Martin, well, he just tried to make it into an utter farce. He put Don Mattingly, his first baseman, at second base. He put Ron Guidry, his star ace, he put him in center field. And then Billy Martin went out and told George Frazier, the pitcher, to appeal at first and second base to claim that George Brett, almost a month earlier, had not touched first or second base. This was so smart. Martin figured that this was a different umpiring crew and that there was no way they could attest to the fact that George Brett had touched first or second base. But what he didn't figure on was there was this little genius in the American League office named Bob Fischel. What he did was plant an affidavit in the pocket of one of the new umpires, Dave Phillips, who pulled this affidavit out from the previous umpiring crew, and it attested to the fact that, in fact, George Brett had touched first and second base. That was it. Check, checkmate. Billy Martin went back into the manager's office and watched a rerun of Barney Miller.
Interestingly enough, Julia Kaufman remembers that her father was calm from the outset. He told everybody the Royals are going to appeal, the decision will be reversed, Brett's home run's going to count. Why was he so sure of that?
I think that was just his personality, you know? He just figured that Wright would triumph in the end and that the Royals, the little market team, would beat the big market team and all those things. And in this case, it did work out that way.
It's interesting to me that you maintain that the Pine Tar game was a turning point of sorts in the history of Major League Baseball. Why was that?
I think that it may not have been a turning point so much as it is the last of the more innocent days that we can remember. You know, we can romanticize the notion of Gaylord Perry's Vaseline on the baseballs and Greg Nettles having his Super Balls in his corked bat. These are the sort of things we can understand. And I think we can understand pine tar, although pine tar really didn't impact anything in terms of the direction or distance of the ball. These days, when one team hacks into the email account of another team, when those sorts of things, these PEDs occur behind the scenes, that's more difficult for us to accept, I think.
I understand that at one stop on your book tour, George Brett himself showed up. What did he make of the book?
He said he loved the book. That's what shocked me, because there's a lot in there that he could have taken personally, his rocky relationship with his father, for example, and mention of the many errors that he committed in the playoff series. The only thing he took issue with was he insisted he did not know that it was illegal that he had too much pine tar on his bat. But the public relations director for the Royals at the time told me that this is something I'd remember more than George would. But in the series before the Yankees in Toronto, we were standing by the batting cage and George turned to me and said, "I don't know how much longer I can get away with this bat." So I gotta go with that quote.
Philip Bondi is the author of The Pine Tar Game, subtitled The Kansas City Royals, The New York Yankees, and Baseball's Most Absurd and Entertaining Controversy. Philip, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Bill. I really do appreciate it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from Sean Gannon, Zoe Sobel, and Bob Schaefer. Our intern is Alex Schroeder, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from George Brett, who 2 years ago told the Kansas City Star what ump Tim McClellan tells people about getting charged by Brett in the pine tar game.
He says, "George is 6 foot, 205 pounds. I'm 6'6", 250. I got shin guards on, a chest protector, a mask in one hand, and a bat in the other. What were you going to do to me, George?"
I bet Brett just wanted to ask about, I don't know, a good restaurant in town or something. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thank you very much for listening.